Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where today we're celebrating raves. Why not? Those were the days 30 years ago that were called the second summer of love, when house music left the house and went rural, some might say feral, and became acid house, rave, jungle, drum and bass. If you roamed around the outskirts of London in the late 80s and early 90s, it's very likely that you'll have heard the dull thud of a bassline coming from a disused warehouse or a deserted field. You might have seen convoys of young, excited people from all backgrounds, black, white, gay, straight, in search of their party destination. During this period, the UK was experiencing the rave revolution, borrowing music from Chicago, New York, and Ibiza, and using it to unite a generation in carefree love and drug-fueled parties. These were illegal raves that celebrated this new wave of music, where the dance floor was egalitarian and spirits were definitely high. In a new series from Sky Arts, some of the scene's most beloved DJs, such as Paul Oakenfold, Dave Pearce, Fabio and Groove Rider, and Goldie, explore the history of rave culture, which a lot of people are quick to look down on. The show is called The Agony and the Ecstasy, and it looks at the entrepreneurship, the musicality, and the camaraderie that went hand in hand with developing these parties, which eventually would become big, lucrative business. On the show today, I'll be joined by the DJ Norman J, Debbie Lee, former promoter for Bagley's and Pasha, and executive producer of the Agony and the Ecstasy TV show, and Alan Miller, chairman of the Nighttime Industries Association, to look back on the days of rave and ask whether a new generation needs a party they can believe in.
Come on, shut up! This is the message!
Full Revolution is on tonight.
Sarge, large number of cars spotted in convoy. Looks like a rave.
Tell me what it's like.
Best feeling in the world, mate. Totally loved up.
DJ Norman J, MBE, Debbie Lee, former promoter for Bagley's and Pacha, and Alan Miller, the chairman of the Nighttime Industries Association. Welcome, you three, at an untimely hour, really, for club people. I'm sorry to drag you into the studio. We are here, as discussed, to talk about The Agony and the Ecstasy, Sky Arts' fantastic new show that celebrates the sort of second summer of love, rave culture, the superstar DJ, and aims to sort of shine a light upon the dwindling nighttime economy as well. So there is agony and ecstasy, and hopefully there will be on the next 29 minutes as well. Here's a question that I'll open to all three of you. But Debbie, I will start with you.
Okay.
Tell us about the genesis of this show. It's got a great title. We know that. We know what it's about. But I thought, you know, like the 60s, the second summer of love and all the rave culture that went with it, if you were really there, you couldn't make a TV show about it because you couldn't remember anything about it. You all have such good memories. Debbie, talk us through it.
Well, first of all, on that point, I do remember because, as I just said to Norman, I was a nice Jewish girl in a rock and roll world. So okay. That's why I remember it.
Taking notes.
But, you know, I got into, you know, becoming a TV producer about 10 years ago when I, you know, sort of I reinvented myself from club promoter to TV producer. And this is something I always wanted to make. But the 30 years felt right.
Yeah.
More to the point, you know, it felt politically right as well, without being too political about it, because I was running clubs before this happened. I'm quite old. And it was so exciting to see a revolution. And I felt that youth today, you know, I feel they're being denied of this experience, this community, freedom. And I just felt this was the time, post-Brexit, Generation Rent, Bank of Mum and Dad. You know, it's not great, you know, it's a bit gloomy out there.
I send that to Holly, the producer of the show. We need something, you know, which was, yeah. Why isn't this happening again?
Yeah.
And maybe it is. I know what you want to talk about.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to provoke, you know, illegal activity, please. But it was the case, it just felt the right timing. But there was another reason that, I've always felt that house music and the nightclub industry is so huge. And when you think about it, punk was a bit of a flash in the pan compared to this, right? Realistically, I mean, I've got all respect for punk, but this was punk, but it was punk to a dance beat in terms of the attitude.
Yeah.
And I really felt that, you know, we didn't have it wasn't honoured as much as it should have been. And I was very lucky to be a TV exec as well as a club promoter that was there. So to tell that story, but I think the gift of this was having the knowledge of the to contribute, you know, the contributors and the cast through personal relationships and trust, that I knew we could tell that story authentically. And believe me, we could have made 10, you know.
Yeah, right.
And I hope, you know, so that really was the genesis of it.
Norman, I want to turn to you because
sure.
Debbie was talking about the DIY nature of it. And I want to talk about the sort of the entrepreneurship involved in it and the threat to it and how it might be bubbling up again. It seems to me about time. But Norman, I want to go right back to the late 80s where episode one of this programme starts. You're our guide for that first instalment of The Agony and the Ecstasy. One minute you were the DJ on a sound system of your own devising, your own making. You certainly knew how to do some soldering and knew the difference between a flathead and a posi drive screwdriver in order to do all that stuff. Yeah. Tell us about your involvement. How did it all start for you?
Well, I always aspired to go on to promote those massive parties. You know, I'm old enough. I come from an era, a generation where young black guys like me, born here, first generation, were kind of denied an awful lot of rights, particularly in clubland, you know, quite racist door policies, you know, not your night, you can't come in, etc. And I looked at this. I mean, it all basically changed for me on my 21st birthday. I go to a club in Essex, black music's playing there, James Brown and all the funky stuff is playing there. And then the doorman puts his hand on my chest and went, "Not tonight, not for you." And I could see all these white kids sort of going in there. I'm thinking, you know what? The penny dropped. It's like an epiphany moment for me then. And I was determined from that moment on to do things, play at parties, create parties and do them my own way, which began, you know, in my parents' house.
Yeah.
I used to hold massive parties at my parents' house. Thank my mum and dad for being so liberal in those days. But, you know, I guess I harboured latent DJing tendencies. I really didn't want to be a DJ, but, you know, I was a serial clubber, an anorak, geeky record collector. I'm going to all of these clubs up and down the country, whether it's, you know, Crackers in the West End, you know, on a Tuesday or a Sunday, or to Wigan Casino or Blackpool Mecca. I went all over the country.
A student of the movement.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Disciple. And I just thought there came a point, a pivotal moment, when I thought I can do this and I should be doing this myself. So 1980, August bank holiday weekend, Norman J, you know, fledges at Notting Hill Carnival with a DIY, homemade, hand-built sound system. But at that time, that was the only platform that was available to guys like myself, you know, black, British born. As I said, you know, you weren't being hired in clubs. You weren't allowed in clubs for the most part. So Notting Hill Carnival was very important in providing a platform for us to do what we did.
Well, I want to bring Alan in. How on earth, Alan, did you know that Norman was DJing, that there were these parties? Because it was such a DIY scene. I mean, now you think it would be absolutely easy, to cross-pollinate and everyone knows what everyone else is talking about, rightly or wrongly. What did it feel like at that point when sort of the music, the house music, was being taken out of houses, or the houses were getting bigger, or there were a house that seemed to be owned by no one? What was the vibe like, and how did you learn about one party to the next?
Well, the thing about great things is that the word spreads really quickly, and it's what everyone in marketing always forgets, that guerrilla marketing is the best form. When someone hands you a book and says, "You really must read this," and you respect them, you do that, and it's the same way. As soon as something's brilliant, it's on the grapevine, and people are talking about it, and young people want it, and that's what's happened. And, you know, that's why the truth shines, and Norman is who he is still with us today, and he's stood the test of time and makes many people very happy.
Physical paper flyers were the only means of promoting an event back in the late 80s, so design became hugely important. The record shops of the time, clothes shops, those places where people could collect flyers, probably had 20 or 30 different flyers on offer. You had a good design, you stood out.
I knew people that copy £5 or £10 notes, write the details in like sort of black marker pen where the rave was, and throw them on the floor outside clubs. A very clever marketing idea.
And I think the thing is that the thing about the communication, and that's what happens, that you get told, "Have you heard about this thing that's going on?" And it's the most important thing, and you've got to be there. And once you've been there and you've experienced that together with different people, you're like, "I've never had anything like that in my life, and I must have more, and I want to be together." So Debbie's point about community, about how we, and today that really is very profoundly missing in many ways, intergenerational and even amongst ourselves, the insular society, how it brought all these different people together. It covers really well the discussion about race and class and gender. This is why it's really important that it's come at this point to remind people of when sometimes they get carried away with a narrative of night, nothing good happens after midnight, just to remind us how it makes our cities and our country better, and it has transformed it in such a positive way. And, you know, you see that with festivals and many, many things all around, you know, just this last weekend in the news everywhere. People love it. It makes the world better.
Wow, well said, right? Who needs
I was just going to add something really quick. You know, we forget as well that if you were clubbing at that time, the DJ had a microphone, he used to talk. And one of the things they used to say frequently, rather than announce the record, was security to the dance floor. That was it at all. You know, because there were so many fights. This scene brought a togetherness and a freedom and a love that's so important as well.
There is, I mean, and this is explored in this, I think, in the second film in the series. And it's an interesting thing talking about the football hooligans coming and, you know, it'd be the firms coming from, you know, Manchester, from Liverpool, from Leeds, all down, coming down to London to play the London teams. They'd all meet up and have sort of organised fights. They'd end up in Bagley's.
My club.
In your club, Debbie. And, you know, they'd rock and roll. They'd take their medicine and suddenly everyone was hanging out on the dance floor, hugging each other, Spurs and Arsenal fans, Man City and Man United fans, or whatever it might be.
It was very deep. Sorry,
right.
Because the thing is, what people don't realise is that environment and whatever they were maybe taking at the time to help that environment, men were never in the position to say, I love you, mate.
Yeah.
You know, it was I think it broke down emotional barriers as well. People were able to talk. There was an intimacy. And I hope that we've never forgotten that, you know, the stiff upper lip British way or geezer way. You know, I mean, I think girls have always been good with their sisterhood, but for men, it was a brotherhood. And I think that really had a big influence as well.
One of the things you touched upon, Alan, was the colour blindness or the wash of it. You know, it was something that was happening kind of slowly. Was colour blindness, sort of gender blindness, sexuality blindness. Norman, I mean, you were sort of at the sharp end of this, as you said, right at the beginning of the 80s. From your point of view, how did you see that change? Suddenly, the acid house culture and the rave culture and the rest of it was such a collegiate thing. What was it like for you?
Acid house culture was very important and brilliant. Because at that time, we're talking sort of early to mid-1980s, the coming of house music made everything very democratic, almost overnight. It threw out all the rules of class and gender for a while anyway. I mean, the elephant in the room here, let's face it, is the drug element of it. You know, it's not a new concept, you know, and people have been taking drugs in England for hundreds of years.
There's a lot of uppers in the 50s, 60s.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, the kind of the drug culture did underpin it. But there were more positives, in my experience, there are far more positives from that than negatives. As you've already alluded to, I mean, the whole sort of football hooligan thing, but that was a sideshow.
I'm not trying to make it about that. I kind of love the idea of some well-known kind
but the
of...
fact that men could love up men and, you know, and, what's the name already said, you know, the girls were always had that down. There was never an issue about girls driving dancing around handbags, but there was this kind of nascent macho thing which was kind of driven by the drinking culture, the beer culture, the fact that if you did that kind of drug you couldn't drink alcohol. I mean, the beer companies hated the rave scene for that, but what it did, it pacified a lot of sort of men who were kind of full of testosterone on a Saturday night, this kind of moody macho thing. You know, during that age or that period, a lot of men discovered they had a softer female side, which, you know, was fantastic.
We created a movement that was inclusive. It celebrated love, tolerance, and freedom.
What about the music itself, Norman? Last time I saw you play was in Thailand. It was in February at Wonderful. Right. So you're always all over it. You're playing everything from Bowie to the Commodores, right back to roots reggae and straight back into sort of acid house stuff. How did the culture, as you started to see it changing and as you were one of the key architects of that change, what sort of different records were you playing and different things you were mixing?
Well, basically it breaks down into two codes of sound. The old analogue kind of live band studio sound on one hand, and then the coming of the digital age. The technology was changing the way we lived, and inevitably it was going to change the way we partied and the way we made music. And the early adopters were on it from the beginning, you know, in Chicago, in New York, and realized they could make music from it. And it wasn't, you know, we weren't very far behind. You know, in the UK, kids were playing with these electronic tools and toys and making music, which was so fantastic. I mean, what we did with it, you couldn't really can it. The only way I can describe it is that house music in the UK, we added the acid. We added the lifestyle, the attitude. In its purest form as music on its own, it's throwaway. It's completely meaningless. So what we did in the 80s was add that let's have it attitude. Yeah.
So there was something about the live element. It was like anything. Yeah, it was the party. It was the thing that brought together.
We took it back from the geeks.
Yeah. Thank you. I love that. And I want to try to set a bit of a scene here. Alan and Debbie, you can definitely help me out with this. Debbie, when you were on the door and when you were working at Bagley's and at Patcher in Ibiza as well, obviously legendary places, what was the vibe? What was the sense of excitement? What were the big nights? And Alan, as a regular on the scene as well, what were you kind of taking from these clubs? Debbie, I want you to kind of set the scene for us first.
Yeah, I think for us it was that going to a nightclub prior to that, you know, there were, you know, clubs before rave that people loved the music. I mean, Hacienda was very famous for that, and there was, you know, obviously the big soul scene, Northern Soul. But I think the feeling was you weren't just coming to a club for a night out. You were coming for a community, as we talked about before. You were coming because you really were into the music and into the scene. So it was a bit more passionate. You know, you wouldn't just go to the local disco because it was Saturday night or the local dance hall, probably in our parents' time. You were actually coming. It was a destination. And a lot of these venues were destination venues. They weren't in the high street and they weren't in, you know, the middle of the West End at the time. There was odd nights that brave clubs like Heaven would put on, or the Astoria, because they had no one else to go in on a Saturday night. And there's by default, they got this great house night. Yeah. But other than that, you know, it was you had to get there. So there was a real importance about being in that queue. You know, you're just going down to the local palace.
It's a bit of a mini festival thing kind of going on there. You have to go out of your way to do it. You have to want a lot of the stuff.
Yeah, and also you had to make a lot of effort. Think about waiting on the M25. Waiting for the M25 for that phone call. And without any social media. Can you imagine without phones that you could mobilise maybe 10 to 20,000 people in an hour?
Well, Alan was talking. Alan said, oh, it was easy. If great stuff just gets out there. But the microscope is put on how this process works very wittily in episode one of this program, right, where you are literally waiting in a phone box for someone to ring, and then they tell you the next place to meet, and everyone's meeting at petrol stations on the M25. What on earth was that like, Alan? Were you part of that?
It was absolutely fantastic. Well, I was part of it as a participant, and also I went on to do things like that in Australia and elsewhere and put on events like that because I was inspired by those first few. But I remember, like, for instance, going to Sunrise or other big events like that, and you'd go to one place, you'd get another call, you'd go to another place, you know, and then you'd finally get there, and the experience, the excitement, and also the engagement also with all sorts of different people. That was part of the journey. It was part of initially it started about a secret amongst a very few and well-informed, and then it just exploded because it was so great. And for me it was really interesting because we did similar things, as I say, in Australia and Asia. I kind of was inspired here and I went to put on those kind of events, and it had a similar effect. And then coming back to Britain after having done that, and we did events all over the world, but then coming back in Britain and going to when it became part of the club scene, when we had, you know, I helped Spiral Tribe put their first couple of parties on in London.
So you better tell our listeners who Spiral Tribe are, because there's quite a lot of, rightly, a lot of airtime given to them in the programme, but we need a small precis.
Well, yeah. I mean, basically, there was a bunch of people that had got together, Mark and one of my best mates, actually, was from Wood Green, this guy called Ronnie RJ, who's now in the States, and he sort of introduced me to them when I got back from Asia. And they had a schoolhouse in Kilburn, and he said, well, listen, the guys just got in, they were squatting, come in. And I helped them put on the first couple of parties. They, you know, the first one got the police turned up, they pulled the electrics off and went, and they went, that's that. And it was like a fusion of one that, you know, I used to go to, you know, whether it was in St Paul's or Handsworth, I used to move around the country quite a bit as well, because I love reggae music too. And it was a bit of a fusion between the squat scene, a bit of like the reggae scene, and this techno new kind of thing that was happening based on acid house and being brought in. And then they went on to do things which culminated in Carlson Morton and the new legislation. legislation has always been about the public. It's never been about private members' clubs. So it's about ordinary people. From the gin laws onwards and the Defence of the Realm Act and, you know, go and fight the Hun, you can't have a drink at this time or that time. And similarly, the legislation from the miners' strike that was used to stop movement of people, to stop flying pickets and then subsequently young people to congregate. And then the Criminal Justice Act really consolidated that. And we saw a lot of people and young people who organised against it and spoke very articulately against it. But the Castle Morton moment was part of that whole combination of thing with John Major talked about that, and then also New Age Travellers and festivals. But then we had clubs coming through, and it showed in the series, you know, places like Fabric and others. And obviously you had the Hacienda and you had others where dance music had, and acid music, you know, had come, you know, the Astoria and others trip, and there were other places like Heaven where big clubs did feature part of it. But the elite, the raves, the one-off big events, they were the things that really blew it out of the water. But then what happened, it came back into the clubs, and both bigger clubs and smaller clubs, and that spirit is still with us now. I mean, you see the importance of those venues and those clubs and those DJs and how that's consolidated. I can tell you a number of people now that are running the most impressive things in Britain, in Manchester and Glasgow, and they have all been inspired by acid house in advertising, in fashion, in music, in dance, in business and science. And there's this kind of legacy that carries on, this continuation that's still there. And it's sort of way beyond just like, when I say just, only DJs or just going out for a night. It's about our cultural tapestry and who we really are. It's about tourism. It's about, you know, people are involved in meshed in our whole, you know, how we understand ourselves today. And it's really quite profound, and it carries on having ripples in design and a whole range of arenas.
Being at Bagley's, being at Patcher, these were super clubs, clubs and super clubs, respectively, perhaps. Was there something, when the music came from being sort of, went out of the clubs, went out into fields, and then went back into the clubs, was there a thrill in the illegality that you kind of lost back when you were back in a club doing it, I wonder?
I think there was a coolness to the scene, initially, yeah. Even though it went mainstream, it was still, you know, the most mainstream people were still sticking their finger up a bit to authority. So we had to get legal, and, you know, we wanted to comply. We knew that something was special. You know, we weren't being anarchic,
yeah,
thank
yeah.
you, for the sake of it. You
I was
know.
Trying to try and help you there, and I mean, couldn't think of anarchic. It for the life of me.
I mean, there was a thrill, but, you know, the truth is that, and this is a little bit controversial, that even with the creative sort of free thinkers, we were still sort of had a bit of Thatcherism in us by default. And so therefore we knew there was, you know, this was a business. And I think actually it's a huge export. And, you know, it's had a, you know, Alan sitting here is like, you know, sort of nighttime economy. You know, we had a huge impact. And, you know, without being too cheesy about it, you know, the music opened our ears, you know, the vibe opened our hearts. And I think that the creative spirit of it, you know, opened our minds.
Let's get some T-shirts printed with that
yes,
on.
There you go.
Yes. Yeah, just our minds on
know,
the back.
Our minds. And I think that, you know, generated so much. So going back into the clubs, we were still creating new experiences. And you've got to remember the clubs before that, you know, were sort of dodgy carpets, you know, smelly old, smelling a beer, you know,
beer.
So, you know, warm beer.
Yeah. And you had to wear smart black shoes.
You know, And you know what? I'm not down in the disco because I love the disco, but, you know, it was tired. And I think what these shell of buildings did was, it wasn't that, you know, we were being cheap by sort of even, because those big clubs recreated a warehouse feel. You know, you look at the Hacienda, you look at clubs like Bagley's, you look at the Ministry of Sound, compared to the, you know, the refurbs that big companies like Mecca were paying for, like, you know, getting, you know, these, you know, which we'd now think as being tacky. It just allowed us to have actually a backdrop of exciting productions that we could put in there and make it our own.
Alan, did the entrepreneurialism of it, the undeniable entrepreneurialism of it, which is very clever, how grassroots did that still feel? Well, how grassroots does that feel now?
Yeah, well, it was totally part of things. And I don't think there's this dichotomy between creative, interesting, smart, lovely people who sometimes get called hippies and people who want to do well and ambitious and aspirational, want to transform things. It's not that it's either one thing or another. I think they really, that we should have a grown-up debate actually in Britain and elsewhere about what being creative and dynamic is. And I think But many people demonstrated that already. We did that through the scene. And just to give it an example, when we set up the Old Truman Brewery in an area that it was considered an objective two area, so really low in unemployment and social problems, and people have said from the West End, no one's ever going to come there. Forget it. You're not going to get VIPs coming to Brick Lane, where the NF used to do demonstrations, and like it was like a disaster, right? And then all of a sudden, what happens is young people take a bit of a risk, and we pulled together, and it was inspired from the Acid House moment, a range of people who no longer had jobs in shipbuilding and coal mining and car manufacturing, and you had to do your own thing. So people who wanted to be DJs or graphic designers or dancers, who wanted to make films, who basically all came together doing fashion. And it was like a moment where we were like, okay, so what is this? Is it a bit like Studio 54 with a bit of Camden and a little bit of Notting Hill? But it's East London. And all of a sudden, young people say, I'm going to take this risk and I'm going to go for it. And we hustled together. And the Old Truman Brewery, 11 acres, 25 buildings. And we did it at peppercorn rent. And all of a sudden, right, people start saying, I'm going to come here, I'm going to do this, and I'm going to put this. And all around it, what drives it is nighttime activity as well. So there's the day and the night. It's the 24-hour experience. And they're entrepreneurial, they're dynamic, and young people, and they still are. I mean, look at Hackney, how that's been transformed in the last 20 years and what that's become. And Peckham, we were just talking about it outside with Norman and Debbie. And you look at other areas in
Brixton.
Chapeltown in Leeds. If you look at places like in Birmingham, if you look at Digbeth and what's happening, and the regeneration of cities, you know, Debbie talked about this being business now. I mean, not just to 66 billion per annum directly, but, you know, in terms of 8% of our employment are employed in nighttime activities, where this dance music culture has been so profound and is everywhere, but also in terms of tourism, destination, in terms of our cultural brand, record sales, you know, the other things that go alongside that, what that means, travel, tourism, destination, who we are, and how that's utilised and across different areas in film and a range of areas. So I think that that thing where people want to do things and achieve them. And make, you know, I grew up a bit in Britain as well. It's a bit like, who do you think you are? You'll never be that. Shut up. And like, but we went with the fighting thing a bit. You're deferential, know your place, don't do that. And all of a sudden, there was a possibility. The hugging went with a possibility. I can, actually, I'm not that thing that someone else said I was.
Yeah.
I can be something different. No, this is
very
not
true.
Yeah. It's an amazing thing. You're kind of touching on, we'll have to sort of wrap, we've got a couple of minutes before we have to wrap. I know. But Alan, to sort of bring it full circle, we talked about the genesis of it, the excitement of it, the DIY nature of it, the amazing music and all the rest of it. Alan's sort of touching on something which is sort of bringing a tear to all our eyes slightly, and not just metaphorically, is that with the regeneration of these areas, take Hackney specifically, now there's a statistic in the second programme, Debbie, which is half of London's nightclubs have closed down in the last 8 years, which is nuts. It's become professional to the point where everybody, no one wants a nightclub at the end of their street. Where do we go from here, I wonder?
I'm going to pass that one over to Norman, because Norman's got a real insight there, because I would like to say, I think it's going to be tough.
Yeah.
And I just hope maybe, as much as we might cringe about it, maybe the government will understand that young people need to have community. It's important. Youth need to thrive together. And maybe it's going to have to be purpose-built areas out of London, but done with great consultancy from people that know what they're doing. Sounds a little bit homogenised, but maybe that's the answer, to keep it legal, authorities happy, you know, and make the great infrastructure people to get there. I hope it doesn't go into a more insulating, you know, a virtual reality experience where you're just having a party for one with people in Sydney. That's exciting in one ways, but it's not so exciting for humanity. So I'm going to hand over to Norm, because I think he's got a real take on this.
No, I think it's good, because us creatures, we're communal, you know, we're tribal, and no powers that be will ever suppress that feeling. I mean, I think it's an exciting time. You know, you've got to take the positive from it. The cycle begins again. The more the authorities repress the expression of youth, it's the more youth will find a way to express themselves. So I've got every faith in the future. I mean, the great thing about house music is this uncanny knack of being able to reinvent itself. You know, kids will always go out. The soundtrack may change, but we will always party. However that manifests itself, it will continue. So I have every faith in it.
I can't let you go.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. You can catch the first episode of The Agony and the Ecstasy this Friday, 11th of August, on Sky Arts at 9 p.m. Thanks to my guests today, Debbie Lee, Alan Miller and Norman J, MBE. You've been listening to Culture. My producer, of course, was my very own Purple Dove, Holly Fisher. And I've been Robert Bound. Join us again at the same time next week. But for the time being, thanks for tuning in.